Nick has changed the presentation a little bit. My colleague Andrew Gower suggested to me earlier, it's easy to give this, you just roll out the presentation you gave 2 years ago and just update all the numbers and change a few pages with legislation and whatever. Basically, that's right, but Nick has bucked the system. He's completely redeveloped the presentation that is behind this, the formal presentation that's behind this, the PowerPoint presentation, and I think that's a good thing. Before I hand over to Nick to run this, because he's going to do something that's completely different to what's happened before, I should comment and relay to you a comment that was made to me on Sunday night at a function by Peter Carroll. And Peter said to me, isn't it good that there are so many young people in the health actuarial fraternity now? And I think I'd go further than that. So I think it's great that there are so many young people in the health actuarial fraternity now. And Nick's at the forefront of that. Nick is at KPMG Actuarial. He has experience in auditing and in consulting to health insurers going back for some years. He's the appointed actuary of One Health Fund. And I think that's a great start at his age. And I'd like to welcome Nick and throw the proceedings open to you.
Thanks, David. So as David's flagged, we're going to do something a little bit different today. This session is really going to be an industry discussion. So it's really your forum. It's your chance to raise the issues that you think are relevant to practice in private health insurance today. To try and give some structure to what we're going to do today, I've actually asked four health insurance practitioners to share a little bit about what they've been working on, what they've been thinking about, and basically ask them to pitch some questions back to the audience. So what we're going to do is each speaker will have 10 minutes to briefly present, but also to engage you in a discussion. We've got two roving mics, so if you do have a question, just raise your hand and we'll see to it the mic comes to you. Please do announce your name and your company. And before we get started, I'd like to say that if you're not working in private health insurance, if that's not your primary practice area, there is a slide deck that is available on the Actuaries website. It's there to help you come to grips with some of the definitions and some of the issues, at least in my view, that are affecting the industry. And I'm more than welcome to take questions on that after this session or via email afterwards. My contact details are included. Yes, and it's a great PHI CPD course. We can talk about that later at cocktail drinks. So I'll pass on to Andrew Matthews, the industry's newest appointed actuary, and he'll get us started.
All right. So I get the gig of being the newest appointed actuary, having just started at Medibank. Most recently had 2.5 years at Ernst & Young, and before that primarily the general insurance industry, as well as a little bit of time at the Transport Accident Commission, which you could say is loosely connected to health or at least damaged bodies. So it's week four. Let me start with, we had a talk the other day from Kevin Gosper being a Samoan chief. Well, I got to be a Maori chief recently on a holiday with the family. And there's a couple of things I want to take you through, but the first impression to me is about remember what's important. It's a mantra of mine. I think family's important. The real Maori chief that's in that photo actually gave us a Maori saying that night that was, I can't repeat it in Maori, but I can do it for you in English. And it was, what is the most important thing in the world? It's the people, it's the people, it's the people. And that's what I love about getting involved in the health insurance industry. It's about health, it's about people, it's about keeping an eye on what's important. Where's Owen? Are you here? Owen said to me at lunch, and I don't want to draw the audience into this a little bit, but said to me, why is the assumption always that more private health insurance is better? And I guess it's about, we're really saying what we want to do is get better outcomes for the people. So it only works as an assumption if we truly believe private health insurance can get better outcomes. I like to keep reminding myself what's important. Oop, staying on the slide might be important. Make a positive contribution wherever you happen to find yourself was something that a mentor of mine gave me. I want to pause for a moment because I think the actuarial profession, I often hear people say, we've lost leadership roles, we're not in the leadership roles we used to be. Actually, I think we have a tremendously important leadership role. A lot of what we do sets the tone of conversation. It sets the tone of conversation amongst the management team. It sets the tone of conversation at the board table, And conversation is what drives changes and decisions and things happening. You know, our FIAT colleagues can change the conversation with new capital guidelines. You know, don't underestimate, you don't have to be, don't underestimate. It's not about being in a power position or a CEO role. You're a leader if you're contributing to the tone of that conversation. And all the people in this room and the ones that I meet have a big contribution to make to that. The third thing I wanted to talk about was health's kind of interesting, right? Because it's a really what I call a wicked problem. And I'm going to go about 10,000 feet above the issue here. But last year I was in China and I was really struck by the change in lifestyle. And, you know, China got 25 million people in Beijing. It's Australia in one city in a lot of ways. So when there's a problem, you start to see it a lot more expanded. And I ran into some people who work for diabetes, the equivalent of Diabetes Foundation, but the China version. And I just want to read you something from a paper that they shared with me. You know, they're looking at some statistics they'd recently done that in China, you know, adults 20 years age or older, 10% of the population have diabetes. Not all of them actually know that. And where are 15% have pre-diabetes. Top that with an aging population. I guess, you know, you've got the one-child policy, you push that out. And one of their findings was the aging population, urbanisation, nutritional changes, decreasing levels of physical activity and a consequent epidemic of obesity have probably contributed to the rapid increase in diabetes burden in the Chinese population. So we have a wicked problem of the health system can't cope with that. You can't fix it. No government can fix it, no government department, no single company. Now, that's China. I think we have many of the same issues in Australia. So we have the same problem. It just becomes what hit me when I was in China. It's a lot easier to see because the scale of it is a lot bigger. So there's interesting. The whole health industry faces, let's call it a wicked problem because it's not easy to solve. And finally, I think it's an adventure because we're part of a really complex network. You know, we're I'm an actuary, but I'm involved in a health insurance company, but we're part of a health system, we're part of a population, and we're dealing with the wicked problem, right? So can I change that? Well, I guess I'm just a grain of sand, right? But remember what I said about the conversation. I'm just a grain of sand, but I can be a little bit intentional about how I go about things and how I go about my work, and so can everyone else involved in the industry. And, you know, as my Chinese friend said, one grain of sand can tip the scales. So I just want to stop there, Nick, and leave with that thought because being new to the industry, I'm standing on shoulders of people like Andrew Gale, who was kind enough to spend 2 weeks with me after his 11 years at Medibank. So it's a privilege and an honour to be in an industry like this and with a company like Medibank.
Thanks, Andrew. Why don't you stay there? Does anyone have any questions for the Chief Actuary at Medibank?
I've given some time back to the room, have I?
Yeah.
I've hit my KPI.
I think a better analogy would be a little pebble that you can get in somebody's shoe and make them uncomfortable.
Yep. Well, a little bit of uncomfortable can sometimes be a good thing, right?
Absolutely.
Rob.
Andrew, I know it's early days, but
it's early days. But you might want to leave some questions for me for the end when you've heard from the others, perhaps. But
what things are you looking to from an industry perspective? Then, what things do you think would be useful to change?
Well, I think it's early days, but I would say, let me pick on two that strike me as early observations. The first one would be, just like every industry, like life insurance, like general insurance, like the UK, we're seeing aggregators, I observe more price competition, I listen to conversations across the industry that are focused on product and price. You know, I'd say classic problem, don't know the solution, but the only solution I can think of would be the word innovate. Now then people say, you can't innovate, it's community rate, it's a set product. I don't believe that. I think there are innovations that can happen. And that's the pressure that we have to create. So that would be my first one. How do we innovate? We have a wicked problem. not innovating and is not going to solve that. My second impression would be, I don't think the private health insurance industry can do this alone. There's going to be a key leadership skill that's required across the industry to be able to collaborate. And I think that's a different skill to being able to lead within a hierarchical company. And the health system is complex. We've got government, we've got not-for-profit, we've got doctors, we've got hospitals, we've got health insurers. And I think there'll be an increasing need to build the skills to collaborate. So they'd be my two early themes. They're not necessarily specific to Medibank, Rob. But how do you innovate, and what are the leadership skills required, not just in a hierarchical perspective, but to collaborate across the system?
It's not a facetious comment this time, Brent Walker.
It is or it's not. I've just got to get ready for that.
I was impressed because you talked about being in New Zealand and also in China. So you obviously got... you're thinking about what's going on elsewhere in the world. Do you think that part of your job in the longer term is to take some of the strengths of health systems of other countries and bring them to Australia?
Oh, look, I haven't got any shame. If I can find a good idea somewhere, I'll have it. I think that we're increasingly interconnected in the world. So to the extent that we as individuals can learn globally, I think it's incumbent on us to do that. I remember being, at a personal level, being struck by a mentor who said to me, you know, we all need to think, as individuals and as companies, what have we got to sell to the world? You know, it's an interesting test to put your own skills to. What have I got to sell to the world? And that, you know, am I able to, remember I said, make a positive contribution wherever you happen to find yourself. So I think, Brent, we've got to look for those good things that are happening. And part of that leadership, I talked about collaboration, you know. When we find some crazy kook out there doing something really well, I think we've got to support that. And so this could be a really great idea.
Thanks, Andrew. Might have to call it quits there. We give Andrew a round of applause. All right, we're going to throw to Indy next. Indy works at Bupa, and he's going to share some of his recent work with us. Thanks.
Yes, this is the first time I'm doing something like this, so I would like to get feedback. So if you think I'm talking complete BS, throw your shoes at Nick.
Good idea.
Sorry, Nick. So I thought I'll talk about customer migration, and I guess health insurance industry, it's continually moving, at least the 7 years that I've been here. And a lot of the time, it's around, you know, people's needs change, their views change, or what they should have changed. And not only that, the legislation and regulatory changes consistently happen as well. As well as the internal focus change. So you might be focusing on profit and all of a sudden you might want to increase your, you know, customer satisfaction or your growth, and, you know, so there's a shift in your strategy. So and all of this results in, you know, you either tweak your existing products or you decide to go and introduce something new so you can meet that new, you know, to meet that new strategy. So from a control cycle perspective, this is, I said some aspect, is I'm sure there's bits I'm missing, so I thought I'd put some aspect, quantify it, qualify it. So with customers, you know, you generally start with the customer. You want to get their feedback, whether it be from your website or web sales, call centre, retail, your third parties or social media, not Bupa, but I'm sure other places get info from social media as well. You try to gather as much as possible as to what the customer wants. And then you can run customer focus groups to sort of work out, you know, all the fancy stuff that marketing guys do to work out, you know, what do they really want, just to sort of get a bit more depth around what members want. And then you can do choice modelling. So this is the stuff around, you know, how much people are willing to pay for one thing or another. It's all fancy stuff. I don't do it, but I'm sure there's, you know, that some of the marketing guys do a great job at it. Then also in Australia specifically, you do have to look at the marketplace where, you know, we got lots of competitors. What are they offering, their pricing, their product structure, etc. And to do that, we have a lot of info. I mean, FHIR got tons and tons of info on the industry stats. We've got SIS that, you know, you can compare products and their benefits in a, you know, whether you think that's the best way to compare, but you do have that info to compare other products. And then we also got regulatory constraints around the community rating, the portability, and the fact that we can't underwrite, etc. So all of that's got to be taken into account, as well as the internal thing. So, you know, if you're introducing a new product, where does that sit in terms of the hierarchy? You know, are we offering better benefits, better price, you know, or cheaper product? And you know, if you get something, it doesn't stand on its own. It's got to sit in your hierarchy. So you've got to sort of factor that in. And what that leads to is to make you think about what does it mean in terms of customer migration, people on your current products, how are they going to move, what behaviour changes are we going to see? And that's the part I want to focus on. So you get all of that, and I'll use my abacus there. You've got two green apple and a yellow apple. That gives you two red apples. So you bung it in there, you get some nice pricing, you go with the product launch, and then this is also the interesting part that I'll get involved in, actually looking at the experience, you know, understanding what's actually happening. So, I mean, you do want to know what you planned out, how the member's going to behave and what actually happened, as well as the KPIs. I mean, things like claims, it takes a little bit of time to develop. You can't monitor it straight away. But things like membership, you know, the movements in membership, you can start monitoring it even weekly or daily basis if you have the capability. And also it's important to get the customer feedback and I think also the front line as well. You can gain a lot of insights around what's actually happening with the front line. So yeah, and then usually the next rate review you try to implement the changes that you have. So from a customer migration perspective, opportunities and risk, I mean, to me, you see the opportunities, you know, you want to, it's complex as it is, you know, you're trying to do something to simplify what you offer. So, you know, if you ask average person, you know, they don't know, you know, what's in half their products. So, and that's why you have those brokers and aggregators that try to simplify it for the people, the street. Also, you know, you could argue that you can move members onto a more relevant product. It's all the new age is about, you know, customising it. It's a product just for you. So, you know, you're not paying for stuff that you don't want. Although you're older and you're going to have a lot more heart attacks and, you know, other costs, but you don't want to pay for pregnancy. So there are things that you can sort of put in that you know, that can show that you're really paying for what you really need. On the risk side, yes, you can introduce new products, but it might be cheaper to, you know, tweak something that you already have and you don't have the migration, so you actually it's factored into it. And where there's no forced migration, self-selection is an issue. So, you know, if you're introducing a product where, you know, you can pay $10 more, but, you know, or and then it's got slightly better benefits and slightly high price and high benefit, what happens is that people might go, well, I'll pay $10 extra, but I can claim $50 more. I'm talking about ancillary side. Similar thing could happen on hospital as well. So you do get the ones, it's not the average risk that's moving from your existing book to the new book. It's the ones that actually done the calcs and go, well, actually, it's better for me, and they're the ones who move. And similarly, if you introduce a product where it's, you know, worse off benefits, but then the price is also lower, the ones who are going to go are the good risk. Go, well, actually, I'm a pretty good risk, so I'm going to go there, and etc. And the part about monitoring, I mean, I talked about regularly monitoring. I mean, I think it's really important that you know, you can monitor the membership as soon as first month, second month, and that gives you insight as to what's actually happening, what you expected, and what actually happened, and also understand where the margin's coming from. Once again, first year is going to be, or first few months are going to be different because you've got the seasonality element, as well as the you know, the rating periods, etc. So you might not see the ultimate claims level, but you can get a view. So I like to break the membership down to this, where I go, well, you know, the new product is broken up down into people who transfer from your existing book, from other health funds, and new to the industry. These ones you can sort of question whether it's really new to you, or whether you're cannibalising your new business that you would have got on other products. Subjective question, thing that you need to make a call on. But more interesting, these migrator policies, you can actually look at the risk profile of that. So it's the KPIs and things that you measure and see how that's tracking. Is that what you expected? So I'll move on to the next one in the interest of time. So the things I thought, since you've got so many senior actuaries and with wealth of knowledge, I'm interested to hear about the lessons you learned from your experience or possible guidelines we could have around measuring migration, etc., capital constraint consideration. So if you wrote in margin, you've got to have, you know, the renewal option reserve go up and you've got to hold more capital. And things around FCR inclusion, whether, you know, if you think it's a material thing that the board needs to know. So I'll open it to you guys.
Andrew Gow, firstly, congratulations. Nick didn't get any shoes thrown at him, so you've obviously done a good job. Just on that last point, I think I see the FCR as probably more than just financial risks. It needs to have a much bigger focus on general business risks in general, because the business as a whole, those general business risks are likely to become financial risks at some stage. Systems will probably an example from outside of health insurance, but each of the major four banks are doing core banking system replacements at a cost of somewhere in the order of $1 to $1.5 billion each. How many health insurers can actually support even a much lower cost system replacement program? But it's a huge risk. I know Medibank still runs on an old mainframe. Bupa has gone through the process through merger and the integration process. But that's just one business risk. Migration is another one, which is a huge material risk, especially with corporate business, retail business, older books, newer books, and also across state lines. We've got a very different, probably, state migration basis over the last 10 years than what was there the 10 years before. So probably Sydney pulled in a lot of people in the 90s as finance became the key, but then as we've had mining go across, we've had lots of risk go across to, lots of people go across to WA and Queensland. Once again, it changes the risk profile of the population and of what we're insuring. So, yeah, I think the FCR needs to be a lot bigger in a number of areas, covering the business risks as a whole.
Agree.
I just want to make a comment. You've talked for 8 minutes or so, and what the ground that you got through in 8 minutes is absolutely great. You've done really well. No shoes in any directions here. I want to just sort of say one of the things that this provoked me into thinking about is starting new products when you've got a world of business there and the new products come along, and the new products, they're all sexy. They get all the attention at management meetings and in marketing development meetings and everything. But it's very easy to just lose sight of the fact that the core business that sort of sits there is going to be impacted by some extent by the cannibalisation that you've talked about.
Yeah. I think it's a real risk, and I think it's the sexy factor kind of takes away. Well, yeah, you're going to have so many members on a closed product, like say when MBF and HBA merged together, you know, 80% of the members on closed products. And so it's really managing, and these are profitable members, so you don't want to drain the profitability. So it's really then how do you manage it to an en-suite product? And I think it's important that as actuaries that we kind of say that, yes, you know, you do need to think about your existing. And so you can't just pluck a product and here you go. It's got to sit within what you existing have.
Thanks, Indy. Can you please put your hands together for Indy? Cam Bronwyn.
Okay. I've gone. Hi, I'm Bronwyn. I'm at Teachers Health Fund. Wrong way. And I was going to chat a bit about broader health cover. So some of you will know more about this than others. Some health insurers are really involved with it. So broader health cover is something that health insurers have been allowed to do for a few years now. It's something the government's really keen to see health insurers doing a lot more of. It's made a big difference overseas. But in Australia, the progress has been slow and steady. So broader health cover is your non-traditional thing. So it's anything that's improving health and well-being, that's managing diseases, people with chronic conditions, or it's offering alternatives to hospitalisation. So that might include things like rehabilitation in the home. Some of these things have been slow to start because finding the providers has been slow to start for some of these things. So it is ramping up, but some companies, you know, we've been looking at rehabilitation in the home. There are some great providers in Victoria. There weren't so many in New South Wales. So we worked with HCF to actually encourage one of the providers to come and start doing more work in New South Wales. But, you know, they needed a core funding to keep them up there, and, you know, certainly a fund of our size wasn't big enough to justify that. The success of the programs is where a lot of them fall down actuarially because we don't know how to measure them. So globally for broader health cover initiatives, there's no single method of evaluating them, either clinically, financially. A lot of people have tried to write definitive papers, actuarial practices, health economists, all sorts of people, but there's no one way of doing it. Which means that, you know, you can read a report that says this program where we call people a week after they've been to hospital to make sure they're taking their right medications reduces the risk of readmission by 80%. That's a huge cost saving for private health insurers. But someone else might measure it slightly differently and go, we think it actually only reduces it by 20% because some of these people, you know, wouldn't go back, or clinical efficiencies changed over the last year. So it's actually really hard to decide what you're basing it on. The healthcare providers always have fantastic stats. You know, they'll always say it does amazing things. How you replicate that and then assess it and decide, actually, is that how we want to assess it for us internally, is a big question. So over the last year, I guess some of the things I've been involved with my health fund is, first of all, targeting individuals who might be suitable for programs, so looking at people's past claims experience as an individual. So as actuaries, we often tend to look at data in groups, actually looking at individuals, age, what they've been in hospital for before, what people who've been in hospital for that tend to go into hospital for again has been interesting. And it's huge data sets, which I'm not a Quantium person. That's not my strong point. We have 240,000 people covered, lives covered. So, you know, if we were Medibank, you wouldn't be able to do what I do, because at the moment I still do it in Excel. We don't have SAS as a company. We do all our analysis still in Excel. And that's only going to last for a little bit longer, I think. You know, we're going to start getting too big for that. And some of the analysis is just nearly impossible. So, you know, I had to put a business case in to get access. So I now have Microsoft Access, and I have an analyst who started this week who hopefully is going to do lots of work for me in it. But we have just hired a statistician as well to help purely in the broader health cover space. Forecasting utilisation of people both on and off the program, so what we think their behaviour would have been if they hadn't been on the program, allowing for improvements in treatment, recovery, etc., versus what's happened in the program. So would our experience have been getting better anyway because health treatments are improving? Some of that's actually really hard to assess, and there's a lot of judgment. So, you know, it's good. It does make you think, which is why I like being involved with this. And obviously, program evaluation. One of the big things we've done over the last year is try and work with the Australian Health Service Alliance, which is the contracting body for a lot of the, most of the health industry, actually, apart from the big guys, negotiates with the private hospitals through the alliance. So what we have been trying to do is get the alliance to use a consistent methodology for program evaluation, understanding that it's not perfect and it will continue to evolve over the time, but we've put some basic measures in place so that we can sit there and go, we've got a contract with this service provider and this is the results we've seen, and somebody in a different health fund who's doing something different can say, well, we're doing something different and this is the results we've seen, and we're talking apples with apples. So that's actually been quite a big thing. And I know it's been discussed with Medibank. Certainly HCF was key in involving in developing some of the basis for that paper. And to be honest, we simplified what HCF did a bit for the Alliance to make it easier for everyone to understand. But it's good. We're sort of laying the groundwork for going forward. So it's quite exciting. There's a lot of initiatives, and I think it's where private health insurance has to go. In some countries, private health, broader health cover type initiatives have become so big that health insurers actually benefit by having people who have a specific condition. So people pick their health insurer based on their genetic predisposition. So they're like, well, my family has a history of heart disease, so I'm going to insure with this company because they have the best heart programs. And they get you on them early, and they have a different sort of risk equalisation to us called risk-based capitation. And the health funds do really well, and the population's actually healthier as a result of it. So I think one day we will end up there. I think we've still got a long way to go. But I can see Brent itching to talk. But I think it's a really interesting spot to be involved. I think there's a lot to learn, and we obviously don't have all the answers. You know, most actuaries don't have clinical experience. You need to be prepared to talk, and you need to be prepared to listen a lot to different perspectives. But I think also when you're evaluating, it's something where you need to have that judgment factor. You know, how much does it mean to our members to feel loved and wanted? You know, to have someone call them up and check that they're okay, and how do you put a price on that? So it does lead to some really, I guess, traditionally not actuarial discussions and thinking, but it's a really interesting area. So happy to answer any questions. And I knew you'd be first, Brent.
Well, it's sort of two questions, I suppose, because the first one leads on to the second one. How do you stop people who are accessing the broader health cover in the fund from telling their mates who aren't insured with you about how good you are so that they become insured? And the second question leads on from that is how soon do you think we can get a decent risk adjustment system in Australia so that we don't have to worry about that first risk?
I guess my first thing is, if people are out there telling their mates how great our broader health cover initiatives are, we consider that a good thing. So, but there are certain things where certain programs are only available to people who have certain risk criteria. So we do have things where, say, a husband's on a program and they say, look, I really think my wife would benefit from being on this program. We went through a phase of trialling that, letting them on and seeing what it was. And we certainly were much less successful with the results. With the referred people showed, you know, there was virtually no benefit from it. It was cost neutral, but there was no cost benefit. Whereas the people who we detected and invited to join the program, there was actually a definite cost benefit that we found. So I guess if people are referring it, that's okay as long as they meet the criteria. But if they're just joining our fund, so long as they're not, you know, deathly ill, that's probably a good thing.
You see, the problem is that if you've got, say, diabetes or something, and you're seeing a practitioner and he's seeing, you know, another 100 other people who are diabetes, you're naturally going to get, well, got diabetes, you're naturally going to get talking to them, and you say, oh, well, I'm with something that teaches health, and they've got all these great programs. And, oh, well, I'm with, you know, Cessnock. Or something that hasn't got one of those. Do you all join teachers health?
Yeah, so I guess...
That's the worry that I
had. Oh, very quickly. I think a huge challenge in this area is the fractured nature of our health system.
Correct.
Like, you can only do the best you can from your data.
That's right.
And even Medibank, with 25-30% of the market, can only do the best we can do with our data. Now, as an individual, I can go through the public system, I can go to my GP, through Medicare, or I can just go and see a lot of the ancillary providers and not get any record whatsoever. So
correct.
That to my mind is something that down the track, to get this idea of the broader health cover really working, we need to be able to cross-reference data sets in a safe and acceptable manner, which brings into a huge range of other issues of privacy. And
yeah, well, I think
else,
even, so. You know, Medicare is one of the biggest providers of broader health cover as well. And I believe even then there's privacy issues amongst you looking at the data of your own members using your services. So, you know, it's quite a complicated thing. And I think also, so long as there's the huge fear in Australia of managed care, that allowing people to see that data is not going to happen for a long time here, I don't think.
We will have to stop it there. Thank you very much, Bronwyn.
I talked too long.
Right, we're going to hear from Rob next. He's he's got a bit of agenda to share about ways that actuaries might contribute to private health insurance reform.
If you've seen it before, pass it on. It's just the same as you've seen before.
My name's Rob Payton. I have been an appointed actuary until recently, but it gives me great pleasure that Judy Wang has taken over from me recently. So that's my background. Now, where are we going to? Okay, so it's been very encouraging today because, first of all, Sophie Dyson and then Jamie and Ashish and now me are going to talk about change in private health insurance. So what I've done is I've gone ahead and produced 17 principles that might be used to change the private health insurance system. So the first thing I guess you'd ask is why now? It's a 2020s problem. Well, unfortunately, a significant funder of the current system has said enough of these cost increases and uncertainties, and it's no less than the federal government. So that's something that we absolutely have to listen to. It's very reminiscent of employers with defined benefit, employee benefit plans in the 80s and 90s, where actuaries played an excellent role introducing responsible change. And the material I'm giving you today is yours. Go ahead, develop your own change plan. I've suggested to Jamie this morning that Health Practice Committee might do a similar sort of job that Health Practice Committee did in the late 90s, which partly led into broader health cover, led into lifetime health cover loadings, a big pardon, and which we've gotten sort of 10 to 15 years out of. I think that change will be needed to sustain the system in the longer term. By 2020, the boomers will be aged 57 to 74, well into the higher hospitalisation utilisation ages, 60 plus. While ageing is not a significant cause of cost increase currently, ageing is expected to increase as a cause of cost increase in the future. And cost increases are the basic problem of the current system, where you've got downgrades as well as people dropping out. Substantial change requires a lengthy transition period, so start now and use a lengthy transition period, perhaps 10 years. So what would a new PHI system look like? It would, in my opinion, have lower premiums for younger policyholders and higher tabular premiums. These are for older policyholders compared to the current, leading to smaller risk equalisation than currently and lower premium rebates than currently, and that will get the government's attention. It will have increased use of savings to meet health costs, especially by people who are over 60. There will be increased personal benefit from personal health maintenance and planning by the policyholder. And there will be reduced rates of tabular premium increase compared to the current system due to increased policyholder knowledge and control. So of these 17 principles, I just want to cover a couple now in a very brief discussion. The first one there, build from Actuaries Institute Health Financing Policy Position. That's on the website. It's the Actuaries Policy Position. Essentially, I used that document in about four or five train trips to develop all these principles. So it was a very powerful tool to just apply in a different context. The policy currently is a health financing policy for a whole of system. Number two, public-private services split, this one here. Health politics is religious in nature, basically, and I think it pays to avoid the Middle East. In this sort of work. So, you just get nowhere in this area unless we stick to the current position and that includes, you know, indirect shifts from private to public. Peter Broadhead advised the Institute's last convention to stick to its expertise and stay away from politics. Fantastic advice. The Institute does politics at a kindergarten level, unfortunately, and we'd be up against fearful opponents. So stay within the current paradigm. Number seven is I've called US managed scare, after what Bronwyn said. Require an appropriate minimum co-payment by the policyholder in respect of each material insured service. So that's the last one here. So what that's all about is sidelining the providers by avoiding medical associations calling these changes US managed scare, because equally we won't get anywhere if that's where the dialogue goes to. And I think, moreover, though, patients need to be involved in utilisation decisions more than they are now. And the last one I want to talk to is just number 11 on the next page, which is availability of provider fees. So FIAC to publish a system, so this is radical stuff, for fee data for each provider and to establish a link to each provider licensing authority. Price disclosure will put patients in a much better position to control costs, particularly for elective surgery. So this is a really big agenda. I would encourage the Institute to take it on, and I would welcome any comments that you might have now or later. I appreciate there's a lot to take in. Nick, I'd also like to just thank you very much for organising the session this way, which I think is excellent.
Thanks, Rob. Any questions?
Good day, Rob. Mark Hancock. Just with your user there, the federal government, could you just give us your opinion on what's the current coalition policy on PHI? I understand that they're talking about selling Medibank, and I just wondered what other changes they had in mind for the overall scheme, if you can give us a summary.
Yeah, I have no inside knowledge, although I do admit that I have lobbied the coalition on various issues to do with the current means testing of rebate. But I've got no knowledge of what they're going to do. But I do feel from a political perspective that this change is attractive to both political parties. Labor, because fundamentally they don't like private health insurance, fundamentally, and therefore anything that reduces the cost of rebates is a useful thing and will hit their sweet spot. And the coalition, because they're interested in private health insurance, but they're afraid of its cost. And anything that would cost increases and anything that would improve that. So I think that this, a change program like this would be very popular politically if properly organised, and it doesn't shift cost from the private system to the public system.
Alan NG, I'm from BNP Paribas, so I'm outside of the industry. And not necessarily just a question to Rob, perhaps any of the other presenters previously as well. I guess listening to this morning's plenary session on the demographic time bomb and how clearly some of the issues raised there was around the implications for healthcare costs from an ageing population, I guess I'm curious to know what your thoughts are in terms of how well prepared the industry is in meeting those potential challenges. Thank you.
Go.
So I guess we're a fund that's been around for a while, but we have quite a unique age distribution. So we have a lot of people just on the verge of, and it's no secret, coming into the highest claim rate. So. And we are nervous about it. You know, we do try and plan for it. We have extra capital set aside for it. But, you know, we're always talking to the board about, you know, remember, this is coming up. We're going to start seeing different claims experience. We're going to see unusual things. And every time something happens, you know, we have a higher claims month, we're like, is this the start? You know, but we don't know. So it is hard, but I don't know what other health insurers are doing about it. But I know sort of people are aware. But for us, as much as the increased demographics, it's also the increased cost of, you know, new prostheses and things like that, because they can blow some of the other costs out of the water.
I can just add to that briefly. I'm lucky enough to be the appointed actuary to the first Australian private health insurer that got broader health cover initiatives going of their own, right, from within their own resources. And going to Canberra as well with the chief executive of the company and presenting to the department about these issues. And what the department told us, which are focused on older policyholders, current older policyholders with high usage health conditions, just like Bronwyn said, we had analysis of, you know, the effectiveness of the programs and what have you. What the department told us, and this is a couple of years ago, was that we were the first entity of any entity whatsoever to come to the department with this sort of data. So I would say that, and the private health insurance industry and the organisation that I was appointed actuary for has moved on quite a bit since then. So I would say that within the private sector, there are initiatives that are being undertaken and are producing results. Generally speaking, the Commonwealth Government is incredibly disappointed with the states, that the states have not, within the public health sector, which is basically administered by the states, have not been taking actions in that regard. But more recently, we've seen, you know, we've seen that happening a bit on, you know, we've seen the ads on television and what have you, but it's a long way from that on television to implementing a successful program. I don't know whether you, would you agree with that sending letters out to policyholders doesn't cut the mustard? Brent?
Yeah.
Nick, you stop this.
No,
when.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask. I'm not going to say much. I was just going to really comment about your point 11. The problem, that's the one where FEACT publishes system level fee data for
each
provider. That's what I was going to say. It's not easy because you can use the same item number, but it's like comparing apples with apples. Mm. When you get into, say, the medical system, we have, I've forgotten how many thousand item numbers now, but we have three or four times as many ICD-10 codes, and even they don't cover all the procedures that are being provided. So, you know, there's a whole lot of grouping going on.
Oh.
It is in private health insurance as well. And the other problem that I saw with it was that each provider licensing authority often don't want to do anything about a provider. They like to refer to the Healthcare Complaints Commission, who say, we're not going to do anything unless you give your name and address and all the rest of it, you see.
I've got one word for you, Brent. Yeah. Change.
if we're
going to have a more cost-effective system,
providers
have to change.
Yeah.
And we have to change too. And if we're driving change, we mustn't be raising US managed care.
That's right. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm very sorry. This clears a lot of appetite to talk about health insurance. Perhaps this is a plea that if you're interested in health insurance, please write a paper. We only had two sort of direct health insurance papers this time around. There's clearly an appetite for it. So if you join me now in just thanking our four speakers.